Well, we were sneaking up on the end of Romans. But after all, we're trying to help you understand how to live. That's the whole purpose of what we're doing here. To get a handle on the world, on life, on ourselves. And if we can't do that for you, we haven't done much. So just think of it that way. If we come, what do we talk about here on Tuesday nights? Is in the direction of helping us to get a handle on life. We examine some of these words because they are words that are often used in the Bible and not often understood. And if a word isn't understood, it's not very valuable to us. So last week we talked a lot about this word which means order. And we were talking about the order of the universe, the order in a way that God makes of the universe. When you see that He has taken so many, many diverse things and made them practical, usable, meaningful, workable, that's quite a marvelous thing. And you see the great diversity of things in the universe. Of course, the word universe basically means the one within the many. Universe, one, una, and versos, which means many. So the riddle of the universe is really what is the one thing that unites the many things together? What is the one thing that ties together a fir tree in the Rockies with an aardvark in Africa, or an ocean wave with a posy in the meadow? You know, what such many diverse things, and what is the thing that ties it together? Because we function within this world of diversity very easily, very smoothly, basically, unless we violate basic principles. If we run our car off the road, we usually suffer some damage. So you can't violate the laws of the universe. You can't jump off a roof without breaking your legs or something. See? So you, there are laws that keep functioning here. But as long as we stay within the frame of those laws of life, we get along quite well for 7 or 8 decades of life on the earth. For all of our griping and complaining and grousing and all of the major and minor irritations of life, for all of these things, we really function pretty well, I think. We stay alive in what might normally be an unfriendly universe. I was thinking of that driving over here tonight and looking at the stars up there, remembering that nothing is between us and those stars out there. We're clinging to the side of this marble out in space and feel quite cozy with it, quite content. And that's a marvelous thing. It's a remarkable thing. When you see the ease with which we function in a universe that has such awesome factors in it, we feel quite content. In fact, we make songs about the stars out there and so forth. But between us and that star out there is a pretty awesome universe, and not friendly unless you have the equipment to be out there. And even when you have the equipment, not always friendly. But we function. And this speaks for the orderliness of society. And once again, I remind you of what I've said a number of times, that we get up every morning with some sense of security. When you go to bed at night, you don't bother to tack everything down, lest in the night the whole laws of the universe reverse themselves and now everything is going to be different the next day. You don't do that. The reason we can even maintain our sanity in this universe is the presence of the Spirit of Christ within us, after all. Now, if you've captured, if gotten hold of that premise, that we are, after all, an extension of God, in a degree. Now, I don't mean to say thereby that we are gods. We are a piece, I don't mean to say we're a piece of God, but in a way His Spirit is extended to us, you see, or in us. So we are like the fingers of God, or the fingers of His Spirit, clothed with mortal flesh. But that is why we can feel perfectly secure in such an awesome universe that has the capacity to destroy so readily the elements of the universe, just like the fire that's swept down through those canyons in the south. Such devastation. And the universe has the power to hurt. But still, we go along with comparative security because the Spirit of God is in us. And it is the Spirit of God in us that gives us that sense. It isn't all insane. Else you'd have to say the whole thing was an absurdity. It's difficult not to say that now, that the whole of life is an absurdity. If you look back over your lives and you see the hope with which you set forth at high school when they wrote the 20-year prophecies and so on, and with what expectations you set forth, and the young ladies getting to the end of high school, many of them so anxiously awaiting marriage. Someone says that love is the star you see as you walk along, and marriage is the coal hole you fall into. Well, I don't really mean to be cynical, but I've seen a lot. Everybody has a great expectation in life when you set forth. And then you look at your life and you see that you've come through so many, many difficulties, trials, distresses, ills and illnesses, relationships that have turned sour, businesses that have turned sour, a lot of things that have. And you look back over your life, life as a great kaleidoscope of confusion, if you want to say that. It's pretty hard to put all the pieces together and make any sense out of it, isn't it? Go back over all the years of your life. But once again, something strange happens when we take the Spirit of Christ into us. What happens is that a certain sense of reality settles in upon us. And we tend to accept life. We grouse a little bit and complain, but we tend generally to accept life as it is handed to us. And even if we're very unhappy with the way certain things go, we still have the basic thought that God is with us. That is, that at least there is a God and there is a meaning to the universe. That there's something worthwhile nevertheless. Even in the toughest circumstances, we accept the idea that there is something nevertheless, that's worth hanging on to. In aberrational cases, and people, that is, by aberrational, I mean the mind sometimes gets skewed, as we say, or gets twisted, and in different ways, and people do decide to end their lives. But generally speaking, normal person assumes that whatever rough stuff he's going through, that there's something meaningful in it. So all of that has to do with this, again, sort of a resume of this word orderliness, that God has devised an orderly universe, and it is not just a mad confusion. It has meaning. And when we have plowed through this earthly madness, we all have the sense that on the other end is something worth waiting for. And that what that something is, of course, is eternal identity with God. What we were originally intended to be when God created us. We've always often raised the question of why God made the world or the universe, and the most reasonable answer that I can come up with is that the question itself is probably not a proper question, because in a way it would be like asking an artist why he paints a picture. You know, it was in him to paint, was in God to create. His very nature was such that he created. And the net result of that creation is a spirit being like himself. Of course, a great number of these beings, but that was his product. A spirit being like himself. Now, that spirit being, clothed in flesh, and set down upon this earth, plows through the circumstances of the earth, and the spirit remains intact. And what God originally intended is, after all, accomplished. So look not to the cloak of the flesh around you. Look to the spirit within to find your meaning. And then whatever happens in the earthly circumstance will be taken in stride as a matter of course. So you won't need to be... that is not all there is to life. It's only the outer circumstance, the outer shell or vessel, if you will. Well, going on in this, in these ending words of Romans, he is saying that the truth of these matters has been revealed to us. The creature has gotten the message somehow that the Creator is out there, that God has made us, that we have this inner spirit nature. All these things that which the Bible gives to us are seen by us with impact. That is, the words of the Bible come with impact. That's an interesting thing in itself, because you can pick up a book of philosophy, for example, and read it and have no impact whatever. You have no sense whatsoever that what these people are saying is necessarily true. You've got a dozen philosophers that are the classics. And you read this stuff, if you do or can or want to, and you don't come away with the feeling that these men knew what they were talking about. It's interesting. Descartes says such things as, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And that's a nice sentiment, but it doesn't move you very much. Anselm comes along with a proof for the existence of God, or a logical statement that God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. And if that than which nothing greater can be conceived does not have reality, it is not something than which nothing greater can be conceived. That was his contribution to the process. And you read that and you don't come away feeling moved from that either. You don't feel that this is a dynamic must for your life. But you read the Bible, you see, and it too was written by men. But you can't pick up the Bible without a sense you've got something special here. See? I put that point to the test in university work, college work. I've given you illustrations in the past, I think, but it bears repeating. I had a class down at Caltech. That is, I taught a Bible class down there. They gave me a room in the school for about a year. Of course, you have a lot of young men there that fancy themselves to be thinkers. And this one young fellow said to me after it was his first meeting, and he said, there's nothing wrong with what you say, but he said, I'm not sure there's any more reason to believe the Bible than any other book. And I said, well, why don't you try reading it? You know, I said, I will guarantee to you that if you pick up the Bible and start to read it, I recommended that you start with the New Testament, which I usually do recommend. I said that you will, before you get through reading it, you will never again be able to set it aside as a matter of indifference. I said, it'll make an impact on you. He had no background for it. He was, you know, his background was agnostic and Zen Buddhist and so forth out of his family. This was raw, cold turkey, as we may say, that he just going to pick the Bible up and read it. And I made that guarantee to him. I got together with him periodically, but within about 4 weeks, I think, he said something to me to the effect that he believed it now so completely that even if I were to say to him that I didn't believe it, he would still believe it, you know. He said it that way. He said, if you came to me and said, well, I was just having an interesting discussion with you, I don't believe it myself, he said, I'd still believe it. And here's a fellow that just came raw to it, you know, had no predilections. But that is true, you know, whereas you can pick up books, and you've read books, I've read a lot of them. They're nice stories or they're interesting observations, but you don't come away feeling that this is divine or feeling that these books are something you can't set aside. But the Bible is different, you see, and we read that and it makes an impact. Now again, I'm saying to you that that is because we're dealing in a spirit realm, and it is the Spirit of God that makes that true. It's because the Spirit of God is in our mind and not just our mentality itself. Theoretically, we're supposed to have evolved through the various species of animal life. It certainly doesn't take much to recognize when you go and visit the zoo that the baboon on the other side of the bars there does not have as much in common with you as one might think. There's such a vast difference, not in the coordination or the motor activities or the sensory activity, not in that, not even in the possibility that, oh, let's say the apes have some kind of social order of a primitive nature, as this Ellen Goodall discovered, a young woman who went out and lived among the simians for a few years. You know, isn't that they don't have certain phenomena that are orderly and organized, but there's no spirit there. It isn't a spirit thing that you're dealing with. Instinct and sensitivity, yes, but not spirits. But we are possessed of spirits, the Spirit of God. And that's what furnishes the ongoing reality in us of life. That furnishes the thing that causes us to hold on. That furnishes the sense of priorities to us, that we can talk all we want to about success and fulfillment and all those things. But I think generally in the end we all recognize that the only ultimate fulfillment is at the spirit level. We talk about priorities, and people may choose to stay home and listen to a ball game rather than come out to a meeting. People make choices that give us to believe the priorities are not all that settled yet. But in spite of those priorities that are a little vacillating, in spite of all that, still there is that deep undercurrent of reality to the spirit that we recognize. And in the ultimate, we would not choose these things over God. If God were standing in a room, or his spirit or something, in the room, and he were to say to you, and you're going to go over and turn on the ball game, and decide not to go to the meeting, and he were to say to you, don't touch that dial, because if you watch that and you don't go to the meeting, I'm going to walk out and you will not see me again. Now, if we really believed that, we'd say, okay, sure, I won't watch the ball game. Oh, that's kind of absurd. But what I'm saying to you is most of the things we choose as priorities that are seemingly earthy instead of spiritual, most of our choices are made on the assumption that we can at least get away with it. You know, we're not really choosing that over God. Even when we make willful choices that we may feel the Lord isn't all that happy with, we're doing so in the sense that, well, maybe he's going to be big enough to forgive us. And we get into trouble over it, and we take our lumps for making our mistakes. But we still somehow have the sense that God is not going to abandon us, even if we've made some unsound human choices. I have referred before to this little character that came out in the 40s, I guess, or earlier, by Red Skelton, a name not known perhaps by some of you here in the room, but some of the older people knew Red Skelton in his prime. But he had this little character, Junior. Remember that little fellow? The Mean Little Kid, that's what he was called, the Mean Little Kid. And he had his mother there, was later Harriet Nelson. I mean, played that part before she got involved in the Ozzie Harriet project there. In fact, Ozzie was the orchestra leader at that time, Ozzie Nelson. Anyway, the point I want to make is the character of that Mean Little Kid was pretty earthy, but he used to always say that, you know, I do it, I get a whipping. And then he says, I do it. So, you know, he contemplates the crime, and he knows he's going to get a licking for it, but he decides to go ahead with it anyway, because he assumes that the licking that he gets will not be severe enough to end his life, I suppose. But I think people make that same kind of choice as far as God is concerned. We may reap consequences, but it isn't all that crucial in our minds, the choice we make. And we're not choosing against God, really, even if it's a priority that may seem to be in his place. That's, as I say, to stay home and watch a certain television program instead of going to a meeting might seem to indicate a very low key spiritual attitude. But in the end, it's not a choice against God. It's a choice assuming God is gracious enough to overlook our childish desires and interests. I hope that I'm getting the point across, because I think it's a very deep point, and if I labor a little, it's because I want all of you to really get it, because this is what helps us to cope with the problems of this life. That's what helps us cope, because inside we know we're spirit and we're not flesh. And whatever happens to this outward frame, or what happens within our earthly circumstances, is only a temporary thing, and transient and not all that vital. We suffer on the earth. We may make mistakes that are fatal or vital. I mean to say, we make mistakes that cause us a lot of difficulty. But still, they're within that realm of the outer layer, see? And those mistakes don't penetrate to the level of separating us from God. Now, when Adam and Eve made their choice in the beginning to disobey God, they were, in effect, going in direct opposition to what God had said. And they did, in effect, make a choice that separated them from God, because as he had warned them, when they disobeyed him, it did cut them off from God, simply because they were, at the point that they made that mistake, they were of such a nature that they could have gone on and lived forever and introduced forever an evil element into the universe. That is a disharmonious element. God could not allow that disharmony to exist forever in his kingdom. So their disobedience of him was, in effect, a choice to separate from him. But in the era of Christ, you see, his death on the cross and the coming subsequently of the Holy Spirit put a whole new angle to that, so that the Spirit is in us, if we may say irrevocably, and the deeds that we perform, which might be unsound, nevertheless do not separate us from God as Adam and Eve were separated from Him. So while I'm not urging people to make mistakes, I'm not minimizing the mistake factor in life or saying it doesn't matter what you do, but I am saying that what you do in this life on this earth is for the most part an earthly orientation and does not rob you of the Spirit of God. It may make life difficult for you, and it may make your sensitivity to the Spirit a little less. If you engage in a life that is constantly running on the thin edge, you see, of the cliff, you do certain things within your life that rob you of some of the finer sensitivity to the Spirit of Christ. You get careless. And it's better to watch these things and not be careless. But I want you all to take comfort from the fact that no matter how ungodly or unspiritual, I should say, that you think you are, that you are not void of the Spirit of Christ within, which, as I have said, is evident because you are here. So whatever offenses you've committed, they have not, at least as of this point, separated between you and God. That's really all very important to know, I think, because, as I say, it gives you a handle on things. It gives you a sense of what it's all about. And perhaps it gives you a sense of comfort, too. Then he goes on to say that this revelation has been made known to all the Gentiles, to all the nations. Gentiles here really meaning whatever is not Israel. All these nations were going to come to this revelation. We're going to get the revelation. I've said to you in the past what a remarkable thing it is that this message, this religious concept, which was fashioned in the Middle East, in the little arena of Israel, has found its way over here to this century and to this country and to this state. So that from the shores that are Mediterranean, from the Middle East, this message has found its way, in fact, just swept, if you will, across the world. And here it is today. That suggests something of the power of it, because during the days of Christ and during the days of the apostles, many systems evolved, rose up, of religion, even some purporting to be the Messiah. See? Many rose up to vie for the world's allegiance in that day and later centuries. But the marvelous thing is the way that message of Christ found its way throughout the world and has now encountered us on the shores of the Pacific, the far western reaches of civilization. We are the far west, of course, as China would be the far east. And by the way, the message went east to penetrate the reaches of China and even up to the Mongolian Tibet, all through the east. And that's a remarkable thing. So the Spirit of God has indeed made himself known to the world. This thing was not done in a corner. And throughout the United States, every person living in any city in this country can find a church or a fellowship of some kind to get the message of the gospel. So there is an inexorability to the moving of the Spirit within that will not be vanquished by life's problems, however rough they may be, or by human weakness, however inadequate it may be. So we are tied to Christ in the Spirit. Jesus says in John 17, he speaks of the believers and he says that they may be one, Father, as we are one. You see, Jesus himself sets that basis and he says the unity between a believer and God is the same as the unity between God himself. So whatever Jesus had on the earth, in the way of the Spirit of God within him, we have, though not in the without measure. See, he had the Spirit of God without measure. We have a limited sense of the Spirit. I think that's all very remarkable, and I think it should give you perspective regarding your problems, difficulties on the earth. If you can weather it, and you can, you will ultimately be out in the eternal identity with God. That is the eternal spirit realm. Well, I think we'll stop. Father, we ask you to take these words now and use them in our hearts to fulfill your purpose in the things that you want us to do. Most of all, to give peace and consolation to all those who are here to sense the Spirit within. In Christ's name, amen.